and Life of Jesus by Brother Mel Ruperkis. Book 5, Chapter 6, 11. Jesus had hardly reached the familiar western shore of the lake after his long absence, when he was challenged by Pharisees and Sadducees who came forth to meet him, and tempting him demanded a sign from heaven. The presence of Sadducees so far from the limited confines around Jerusalem is some indication of the alarm which was intensifying there as the popularity of Jesus spread through Galilee. The demand for a sign would not have been an insult had not the actions and words of Christ been constantly supported by the authority of his miracles. It was the responsibility of the leader of Israel to test the prophet by asking a sign, and their rabbinical writings show a number of cases where it was asked and given. Here was a prophet who set at naught the tradition of the elders, who broke their precepts, and whose teaching differed gravely from theirs in several important particulars. Moreover, he had openly countercharged them with hypocrisy when they deposed him. They acknowledged his power, but not its source. How easily Jesus could have satisfied their request. He could have left them pale and trembling by the might at his command. But that was not the way of Jesus. He allowed them to be their own judges. Because of the hardness of their hearts, this was the worst punishment they could have for their contempt of the Son of God. There would be weeping and gnashing of teeth. He who comes to Christ, whether in challenge or inquiry, cannot demand a spectacular display of power. Enduring trust will come from a gradual appreciation and an assimilation of love, a love that glows in humble glory. Such trust finds its birth in the dimly lit stable of a crowded inn and leads on to a lonely son of man, carrying the burden of all humanity to a rough wooden cross outside a city wall. These Pharisees and Sadducees had not learned this. Countless of their countrymen had learned it, and so had a Roman centurion and a Syrophoenician woman. The great army of Galileans, glowing with restored health, had no message for these supercilious leaders from Jerusalem. They needed a sign from heaven. They tempted him. Did Jesus know that at this very place, less than 40 years hence, the sea would be dyed with Jewish blood, when the armies of Vespasian marched upon Galilee from the north? He sighed deeply in his spirit. He understood their motive, and he knew their hardness. He foresaw the ruin they were bringing upon themselves and their country. Only a wicked and an adulterous generation would seek a sign in Israel at this time. He refused the demonstration they asked for, but he gave them a warning. They looked into the heavens in the morning and the evening, and from the colour of the sky they could discern the signs of the approaching weather. Could they not lift up their heads in Israel and see the signs of the coming storm? Their present mission was an omen. Yes, he would give them a sign that the Ninevites received when their judgment appeared imminent, the sign of the prophet Jonah. The people of Nineveh accepted the preaching of Jonah. 3 days was a sad and terrible symbol. If it was ignored, that threatening storm would break over their heads with a relentless fury Nineveh had not known. Having given them a sign which could have proved greater than any display of power had they desired to have received it, Jesus left them and went with his disciples into the boat. They now embarked upon a further journey away from the crowds towards the northern mountains. They beached their boat on the desert shore of Bethsaida Julius, the place which had been the scene of the first great miracle of the bread. It would appear that Jesus had been silent during the crossing, reflecting on the encounter he'd just had with the Pharisees and Sadducees. But immediately upon landing, he spoke to his disciples. Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. The disciples were perplexed by his warning and reasoned among themselves. They finally decided that it must have something to do with the fact that they'd forgotten to bring bread. Jesus sternly reprimanded them. for their lack of faith and reminded them of his ability to supply bread. Then they perceived that he spoke of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. In warning his disciples against the Pharisees and Sadducees, Jesus did not speak of the leaven of each, but of the leaven that was common to the two. We have seen that superficially the two parties were widely different. The one was strict, intensely nationalistic, and preoccupied with ritual. The other was lax, sympathetic to outside culture and philosophy, and sceptical. The leaven of the Pharisees was hypocrisy, but the leaven of the Sadducees was materialism. Each had to be avoided. Yet they had joined on the opposite shore in common cause, and therefore the leaven to be particularly careful of was the result of their attitude to Christ. The key to the danger takes us back to the charges Jesus had already laid against them. His accusation was that as sign seekers they were wicked, adulterous and blind. It was an accusation levelled against them for their common attitude to the things of God. They were all of this world. The Pharisees in their hypocrisy used their devotions to be seen of men, and patronising this world they had their reward. The Sadducees in their scepticism and licence made little pretence of seeking anything other than temporal rewards. Both parties joined in hostility against Jesus because he represented the things of God. Both were ungodly, alive to self and dead to God. In our study of the life of Jesus, if our study of the life of Jesus is to bear fruit, truly in our own lives we must be continually learning the lessons in which it abounds. The leaven against which Jesus warned his disciples has not been destroyed. Hypocrisy is not extinct, nor materialism. They unite in that baser leaven of ungodliness, which can by its very nature permeate our lives and estrange us from God, from Christ and his kingdom. Before Jesus and his disciples left the village of Bethsaida to begin their journey northwards, the people brought a blind man and besought Jesus to touch him. He did not comply with their request. Instead, we have the moving and significant picture of Jesus leading the blind man by the hand, taking him out of the town into the country where he would be free from the embarrassment of the crowds, and where his first vision would be of the creative works of God and of the Saviour who was the beginning of God's new creation. This healing differs from similar miracles because it was performed gradually. First, Jesus put his own saliva on the man's eyes, touched them and asked if he saw. The man looked up and with blurred vision saw in the distance the crowds from the town coming towards him. "I see," he said, "men as trees walking." Once more Jesus touched him, and this time looking up he saw every man clearly. We may wonder why Jesus thus delayed the perfect cure. Without the instruction afforded by the record we do not know, and even then we can only reverently surmise, being careful to avoid presumption. Thus it would seem, as it has often been shown in the Gospels, that the answer lies in the imperfect faith of the sufferer. This man did not come to Jesus himself. He was brought to him by the townsfolk. And even when he stood before him, he had no word of supplication. The people appealed on his behalf. In this we see a further object in Jesus leading him out of the town. As we have noticed before in cases of immature faith, Jesus sought to perfect it in the process of healing. Thus, when the blind man looked up to see, even dimly, for the first time, his faith would soar, and he would believe that Jesus could complete the cure. Thus prepared, the second touch perfected his sight. The restored man was told to avoid the town and go straight to his home. The lesson and the warning of this miracle can be clearly seen. According to our faith, will our spiritual vision be? So often, perfect faith comes only slowly in a development which begins with a blurred vision of men as trees walking. We need the courage and honesty of the blind man in confessing his immaturity. Finally, our first service, when we have received sight, must be undertaken in the seclusion of our own hearts. There, in worship and gratitude, we may prepare for a dedication which will later find expression in witnessing to his name in the city.